I half expected old Lady Zucker to be at her kitchen window glaring at me, but she had moved out to Scottsdale years ago. I don't know who lived here anymore. I didn't even know if the path was still there. It was black hole dark in the yard. No lights were on in the house. I tried to remember where exactly the path was. Actually, that took no time. You remember stuff like that. It's automatic. I ran toward it and something whacked me in the head. I felt the thud and fell on my back. My head swam. I looked up. In the faint moonlight, I could see a swing set. One of those fancy wooden ones. It hadn't been there in my childhood, and in the dark, I hadn't seen it. I felt woozy, but time was key here. I leapt to my feet with too much bravado, reeling back. The path was still there. I headed along it as fast as I could. Branches whipped my face. I did not care. I stumbled on a root. I did not care. The Zucker path was not long, maybe 40-50 feet. It opened into a big clearing of soccer fields and baseball diamonds. I was still making good enough time. If she had taken this route, I would be able to spot her in the recreational expanse. I could see the smoky haze from the fluorescent lights drifting down from the field's parking lots. I burst out into the opening and quickly scanned my surroundings. I saw several sets of soccer posts and one chain-link backstop. But no woman. Damn. I had lost her. Again. My heart fell. I don't know. I mean, when you thought about it, what was the point? This whole thing was stupid, really. I looked down at my feet. They hurt like hell. I felt a trickle of what was probably blood on my right sole. I felt like an idiot. A defeated idiot at that. I started to turn away. Hold the phone. In the distance, under the lights of the parking lot, there was a car. One solitary car, all by its lonesome. I nodded to myself and followed my thoughts. Let's say that the car belonged to the woman. Why not? If it doesn't, well, nothing lost, nothing gained. But if it did, if she had parked here, it made sense. She parks, she goes through the woods, she stands in front of my house. Why she would do any of this, I had no idea. But for right now, I decided to go with it. Okay, if that was the case, if that was her car, then I could conclude that she had not yet departed. No flies on me. So what had happened here? She spotted, she runs, she starts heading down the path, and she realizes that I might follow. I almost snapped my fingers. The mystery woman would know that I had grown up in this neighborhood and thus might remember the path. And if I did, if I somehow put together, as I had, that she would use the path, then I would spot her in the opening. So what would she do? I thought about it, and the answer came pretty quickly. She would hide in the woods along the path. The mystery woman was probably watching me at this very moment. Yes, I know that this argument barely reached the level of flimsy conjecture, but it felt right, very right. So, what to do? I gave a heavy sigh and said out loud, "Damn." I slumped my shoulders as though deflated, trying hard not to oversell this, and started trudging back through the path to the Zucker place. I lowered my head, my eyes swerving left and right. I walked delicately, my ears alert, straining to hear a rustle of some sort. The night remained silent. I reached the end of the path and kept walking as if I were heading home. When I was deep in the thicket of darkness, I dropped to the ground. I commando crawled back under the swing set toward the path's opening. I stopped and waited. I don't know how long I stayed there. Probably not more than 2 or 3 minutes. I was about to give up when I heard the noise. I was still on my stomach, my head raised. The silhouette rose and started down the path. I scrambled to my feet, trying to stay quiet, but that was a major no-go. The woman spun toward the sound, spotting me. "Wait," I shouted. "I just want to talk to you." But she had already darted back into the woods. Off the path, the woods were thick, and yep, it was plenty dark. I could lose her easily. I was not about to risk that, not again. Maybe I couldn't see her, but I could still hear her. I jumped into the thicket and almost immediately hit a tree. I saw stars. Man, that had been a dumb move. I stopped now and listened. Silence. She had stopped. She was hiding again. So now what? She had to be nearby. I considered my options and then thought, the hell with it. Remembering where I had last heard a noise, I leapt at the spot, spread eagle, my hands and legs stretched to the max so that my body would cover as much territory as possible. I landed on a shrub, but my left hand touched something else. She tried to crawl away, but my fingers closed tight around her ankle. She kicked at me with a free leg. I held on like a dog digging his teeth in. "Let go of me," she shouted. I did not recognize the voice. I did not let go of her ankle. "What the? Let go of me?" No. I got some leverage and pulled her toward me. It was still too dark, but my eyes were beginning to adjust. I gave another tug. She rolled onto her back. We were close enough now. I was finally able to see her face. It took a few moments to register. The memory was an old one, for one thing. The face, or what I could see of it, had changed. She looked different. What gave it away, what helped me recognize her, was the way her hair had fallen in front of her face during our tussle. That was almost more familiar than the features. The vulnerability of the pose, the way she now avoided eye contact. And of course, living in that house I had always so closely associated with her, had kept her image in the forefront of my memory banks. The woman pushed her hair to the side and looked up at me. I fell back to school days, the brick building barely 200 yards from where we now lay. Now, maybe it made some sort of sense. The mystery woman had been standing in front of the house where she used to live. The mystery woman was Dina Levinsky. Chapter 10. We sat at the kitchen table. I made tea, a Tazo blend of Chinese green I'd bought at Starbucks. It was supposed to soothe. We'd see. I handed Dina a cup. "Thank you, Mark." I nodded and sat across from her. I had known Dina my whole life. I knew her in the way only a kid can know another kid, the way only elementary school classmates know each other, even though I don't think we ever really spoke to one another. We all have a Dina Levinsky in our past. She was the class victim, the girl so much an outcast, so often teased and abused, you wonder how she stayed sane. I never picked on her, but I stood on the sidelines plenty of times. Even if I didn't reside in her childhood home, Dina Levinsky would still live in me. She lives in you, too. Quick, who was the most picked-on kid in your elementary school? Right. Exactly. You remember. You remember their first and last name and what they looked like. You remember watching them walk home alone or sitting in the cafeteria in silence. Whatever. You remember. Dina Levinsky stays with you. I hear you're a doctor now, Dina said to me. Yes. And you? A graphic designer, an artist. I have a show in the village next month. Paintings? She hesitated. Yes. You were always a good artist, I said. She cocked her head, surprised. You noticed? There was a brief pause. Then I found myself saying, I should have done something. Dina smiled. No, I should have. She looked good. No, she had not grown into a beauty like those ugly duckling swans you see in the movies. First off, Dina had never been ugly. She had been plain. Maybe she still was. Her features were still too narrow, but they worked better on an adult face. Her hair, so drippy in her youth, had body now. Do you remember Cindy McGovern? She asked me. Sure. She tortured me more than anyone. I remember. Well, this is funny. I had an exhibit a few years back at a gallery in Midtown, and Cindy shows up. She comes up to me and gives me a big hug and kiss. She wants to talk about old times, you know, like, remember how dorky Mr. Lewis was? She's all smiles, and I swear, Mark, she didn't remember what she'd been like. She wasn't pretending, either. She just totally blocked out how she'd treated me. I find that sometimes. Find what? Dina raised the cup with two hands. No one remembers being the bully. She hunched over. Her eyes darted about the room. I wondered about my own remembrance. Had I just been on the sidelines? Or was that, too, some sort of revisionist history? This is so messed up, Dina said. Being back in this house? Yeah. She put down the cup. I guess you want an explanation. I waited. Her eyes started darting again. You want to hear something bizarre? Sure. This is where I used to sit. I mean, when I was a kid. We had a rectangular table, too. I always sat in the same spot. When I came in here now, I don't know, I just naturally gravitated to this chair. I guess that's part of the reason why I was here tonight. I'm not sure I understand. This house, she said. It still has a pull on me. A hold. She leaned forward. Her eyes met mine for the first time. You've heard the rumors, haven't you? About my father and what happened here? Yes. They're true, she said. I forced myself not to wince. I had no idea what to say. I thought about the hell of school. I tried to add on to that the hell of this house. It was unfathomable. He's dead now. My father, I mean. He died 6 years ago. I blinked and looked away. I'm okay, Mark. Really. I was in therapy. Well, I mean, I still am. Do you know Dr. Radio? No. That's his real name. Stanley Radio. He's pretty famous for the radio technique. I've been with him for years. I'm much better. I'm over the self-destructive tendencies. I'm past feeling worthless. It's funny, though. I got over it. No, I mean it. Most victims of abuse have commitment and sex issues. I never did. I'm able to be intimate, no problem. I'm married now. My husband is a great guy. It's not happily ever after, but it's pretty damn good. I'm glad, I said, because I had no idea what else to say. She smiled again. Are you superstitious, Mark? No. Me neither. Except, I don't know. When I read about your wife and daughter, I started to wonder about this house, bad karma and all that. Your wife was so lovely. You knew Monica? We'd met. When? Dina did not reply right away. Are you familiar with the term trigger? I remembered it from my medical school rotations. You mean in terms of psychiatry? Yes. You see, when I read about what happened here, it was a trigger. Like with an alcoholic or anorexic. You're never fully cured. Something happens, a trigger, and you fall back into bad patterns. I started biting my nails. I started doing physical harm to myself. It was like I had to face down this house. I had to confront the past in order to defeat it. And that's what you were doing tonight. Yes. And when I spotted you 18 months ago, same thing. I sat back. How often do you stop by? Once every couple of months, I guess. I park at the school lot and come through the Zucker path. But there's more to it than that. More to what? My visits. See, this house still holds my secrets. I mean that literally. I'm not following. I keep trying to work up the courage to knock on the door again, but I can't do it. And now I'm inside, in this kitchen, and I'm okay. She tried to smile as if to prove the point. But I still don't know if I can do it. Do what? I asked. I'm babbling. Dina started scratching the back of her hand, hard and fast, digging her nails in and nearly breaking skin. I wanted to reach out to her, but it felt too forced. I wrote it all down in a journal. What happened to me? It's still here. In the house? She nodded. I hid it. The police went through here after the murder. They searched this place pretty good. They didn't find it, she said. I'm sure of it. And even if they did, it's just an old journal. There'd be no reason for them to disturb it. Part of me wants it to stay put. It's over and done with. You know what I mean? Let sleeping dogs lie. But another part wants to let it out into the light. Like it's a vampire and the sunshine will kill it. Where is it? I asked. In the basement. You have to stand on the dryer to get to it. It's behind one of the ducts in the crawl space. She glanced at the clock. She looked at me and hugged herself. It's getting late. Are you okay? The eyes were darting again. Her breathing was suddenly uneven. I don't know how much longer I can stay here. Do you want to look for your journal? I don't know. Do you want me to get it for you? She shook her head hard. No. She stood, gulping air now. I'd better go now. You can always come back, Dana. Anytime you want. But she wasn't listening. She was in full panic mode and heading for the door. Dina? She suddenly spun toward me.
Did you love her?
What?
Monica. Did you love her? Or was there someone else?
What are you talking about? Her face drained of color. She stared at me now, backing away, petrified.
You know who shot you, don't you, Mark?
I opened my mouth, but nothing came out. By the time I found my voice, Dina had turned away.
I'm sorry, I have to go.
Wait. She flung the door open and ran out. I stood by the window and watched her scurry back up toward Phelps Road. This time I chose not to follow. Instead, I turned, and with her words, "You know who shot you, don't you, Mark?" still reverberating in my ears, I sprinted to the basement door. All right, let me explain something here. I was not going down into the dingy, unfinished sub-dwelling to invade Dina's privacy. I did not pretend to know what was best for her, what might salve her horrendous pain. Many of my psychiatry colleagues would disagree, but sometimes I wonder if the past is better left buried. I don't have the answer, of course, and as my psychiatry colleagues would remind me, I don't ask them for their take on the best way to handle a cleft palate. So in the end, all I know for certain is that it is not my place to decide for Dina. And I was not going in the basement out of curiosity about her past, either. I had no interest in reading the details of Dina's torment. In fact, I actively did not want to know them. To speak selfishly, I was creeped out plenty just knowing such horrors had occurred in the place I call home. It was already enough in my face, thank you very much. I needed to hear or read no more. So what exactly was I after? I hit the light switch. A bare bulb came on. I was putting the pieces together even as I started to descend. Dina had said several curious things. Putting aside the most dramatic for a moment, I was starting to pick up on the more subtle ones. It was a night of spontaneous behavior on my part. I decided to let the trend continue. First off, I remembered how Dina, when she was still the mystery woman on the sidewalk, had taken a step toward the door. I know now, as Dina herself had told me, that she'd been trying to work up the courage to knock on the door again. Again. Knock on the door again. The obvious implication was that Dina had, on at least one other occasion, worked up the courage to knock on my door. Second, Dina had told me that she had met Monica. I could not imagine how. Yes, Monica, too, had grown up in this town, but from all I knew of her, she might as well have grown in a different, more opulent era. The Portman estate was on the opposite end of our rather sprawling suburb. Monica had started boarding school at a young age. No one in town knew her. I remember seeing her once at the Colony movie theater over the summer of my sophomore year in high school. I had stared. She had studiously ignored me. Monica had that whole remote beauty thing down pat by then. When I met her years later, she actually coming on to me, the flattery turned my head. Monica had seemed so fabulous at a distance. So how, I wondered now, had my wealthy, remote, beautiful wife met poor, drab Dina Levinsky? The most likely answer, when you consider the again comment, was that Dina had knocked on the door and Monica had answered. They met then. They probably talked. Dina probably told Monica about the hidden journal. You know who shot you, don't you, Mark? No, Dina. But I plan on finding out. I had reached the cement floor. Boxes that I would never throw away and never open were piled everywhere. I noticed, perhaps for the first time, that there were paint splatters on the floor. A large variety of hues. They'd probably been here since Dina's time. A reminder of her sole escape. The washer and dryer were in the corner on the left. I moved slowly toward them in the shadowy light. I tiptoed, actually, as though I were afraid of waking Dina's sleeping dogs. Stupid, really. As I said before, I am not superstitious, and even if I were, even if I believed in evil spirits and the like, there was no reason to fear angering them. My wife was dead, and my daughter was missing. What else could they do to me? In fact, I should disturb them, make them act, hope they let me know what really happened to my family. To Tara. There it was again. Tara. Everything circled back to her eventually. I don't know how she fitted into all this. I don't know how her kidnapping was connected to Dina Levinsky. It probably wasn't. But I was not turning back. You see, Monica never mentioned meeting Dina Levinsky. I found that odd. True, I am building this ridiculous theory on pure foam. But if Dina had indeed knocked on the door, if Monica had indeed opened it, you would think that my wife would have mentioned it to me at some point. She knew that Dina Levinsky had gone to school with me. Why keep her visit, or the fact that they had met, a secret? I hopped up on the dryer. I had to both crouch and look above me. Dust city. Spiderwebs were everywhere. I saw the duct and reached up. I felt around. It was difficult. There was a web of pipes, and my arm was having trouble fitting between them. It would have been much easier for a young girl with thin arms. Eventually, I worked my hand through the copper. I slid my fingertips to the right and pushed up. Nothing. My hand crawled a few more inches over and pushed again. Something gave way. I pulled up my sleeve and twisted my arm in another inch or two. Two pipes pressed against my skin, but they gave enough. I was able to reach into the crawl space. I felt around, found something, pulled it into view. The journal. It was a classic school notebook with the familiar black marble cover. I opened and paged through it. The handwriting was minuscule. It reminded me of that guy in the mall who writes names on a grain of rice. Dina's immaculate penmanship, belying no doubt the content, started at the very top of the sheet and ran all the way to the bottom. There were no left or right margins. Dina had used both sides of every sheet. I did not read it. Again, that was not what I had come down for. I reached back up and put the journal back in its place.
I don't know how this would set me with the gods. If just touching it would unleash a King Tut-like curse, but again, I didn't care very much either. I felt around again. I knew. I don't know how, but I just knew. Eventually, my hand hit something else. My heart thumped. It felt smooth. Leather. I pulled it into view. Some dust followed. I blinked the particles out of my eyes. It was Monica's Day Runner. I remembered when she bought it at some chic boutique in New York. Something to organize her life, she'd told me. It had had the customary calendar and datebook. When had we bought it? I wasn't sure. Maybe 8, 9 months before she died. I tried to remember the last time I'd seen it. Nothing came to me. I jammed the leather planner between my knees and put the ceiling panel back in place. I grabbed the datebook and climbed down from the dryer. I considered waiting until I got upstairs into better light, but no way. The datebook had a zipper. Despite the dust, it opened smoothly. A CD fell out and landed on the floor. It glittered in the low light like a jewel. I picked it up by the edges. There was no label on it. Memorex had manufactured it. CDR, it said. 80 minutes. What the hell is this? One way to find out. I hurried upstairs and booted up my computer. Chapter 11. When I put the disc into the CD drive, the following screen appeared. Password, blank, 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 blank. MVD. Newark, New Jersey. 6-digit password. I typed in her birthday. No go. I tried Tara's birthday. No go. I put in our anniversary and then my birthday. I tried the code for our ATM. Nothing worked. I sat back. So now what? I debated calling Detective Regan. By now it was closing in on midnight, and even if I could reach him, what exactly would I say? Hi, I found a CD hidden in my basement, rush over? No. Hysterics would not work here. Better to show calm, to feign rationality. Patience was key. Think it through. I could call Regan in the morning. Nothing he could or would do tonight anyway. Sleep on it. Fine, but I was not about to give up quite yet. I logged onto the internet and brought up a search engine. I typed in MVD in Newark. A listing popped up. MVD, most valuable detection. Detection? There was a link to a website. I clicked it and the MVD website came up. My eyes did a quick scan. MVD was a group of professional private investigators who provided confidential services. They offered online background checks for less than $100. Their ads exclaimed, "Find out if that new boyfriend has a criminal record," and "Where is your old sweetheart? Maybe she's still pining for you." Stuff like that. They also did more intense, discreet investigations for those who required such things. They were, per the top banner, a full-service investigative entity. So, I asked myself, what had Monica needed investigating? I picked up the phone and dialed MVD's 800 number. A machine picked up, no surprise considering the hour, and told me how much they appreciated my call and that their office opened at 9 in the morning. Okay, I'd call back then. I hung up the phone and pressed the E-Drive's eject button. The CD slid into view. I lifted it up by the edges and checked for, I don't know, clues, I guess. Nothing new. Time to think here. It seemed pretty clear that Monica had hired MVD to investigate something, and that this CD contained whatever it was she wanted investigated. Not exactly a brilliant deduction on my part, but it was a start. Let's go back, then. Fact is, I had no idea what Monica wanted investigated, or why, or any of that. But if I was right, if this CD did indeed belong to Monica, if she had hired a private investigator for whatever reason, it would naturally follow that she would have had to pay MVD for said services. I nodded. Okay, a better start. But, and here is where confusion immediately set in, the police had thoroughly combed through our bank accounts and financial records. They had scrutinized every transaction, every Visa purchase, every written check, every ATM withdrawal. Had they seen one to MVD? If so, they had either found nothing or decided not to tell me. Of course, I had not been a potted plant here. My daughter was gone. I, too, had examined those financial statements. There was nothing to any detective agency, nor were there any cash withdrawals out of the ordinary. So what did that mean? Maybe this CD was old. That was a possibility. I don't think any of us checked transactions going back more than 6 months before the attack. Maybe her relationship with Most Valuable Detection predated that. I could probably check through the old statements. But I wasn't buying it. This CD was not old. I was fairly certain of that. And it didn't matter much anyway. Time frame, when I thought about it, was irrelevant. Recent or otherwise, the key questions remained. Why would Monica hire a private investigator? What was password protected on that damn CD? Why had she hidden it in that creepy space in the basement? What, if anything, did Dina Levinsky have to do with any of this? And most important, did it have anything to do with the attack? Or was this all a big exercise in wishful thinking on my part? I looked out the window. The street was clear and silent. Suburbia sleeps. No more answers would come tonight. In the morning, I would take my father for our weekly walk, and then I would call MVD and maybe even Regan. I climbed into bed and waited for sleep. The phone next to Edgar Portman's bed rang at 4:30 in the morning. Edgar jerked awake, pulled out in mid-dream, and fumbled with the phone. "What?" he barked. "You said to call as soon as I knew?" Edgar rubbed his face. "You have the results."
"I do."
"And?"
"It's a match."
Edgar closed his eyes. "How certain are you?"
"It's preliminary. If I were taking it to court, I'd need a few more weeks to line up all the arrows. But that would just be following proper protocol."
Edgar could not stop shaking. He thanked the man, put the phone back in its cradle, and began to prepare. Chapter 12. At 6 the next morning, I left my house and walked down the block. Using a key I've had since college, I unlocked the door and slipped into my childhood home. The years had not been a friend to this dwelling, but then again, it hadn't been featured in House and Garden, except maybe as one of their before photos to begin with. We'd replaced the shag carpet 4 years ago. The blue-white speck had been so faded and threadbare it practically replaced itself.
and went with close-cropped office gray so that my father's wheelchair could move with ease. Other than that, nothing had been changed. The over-varnished side tables still held Yadro porcelain knick-knacks from a long-ago trip to Spain. Holiday Inn-like oils of violins and fruit. None of us are the least bit musical or, fruity. Still adorned the white-painted wood paneling. There were photos on the fireplace mantel. I always stopped and looked at the ones of my sister Stacy. I don't know what I was looking for. Or maybe I do. I was searching for clues, for foreshadowing. I was searching for any hint that this young, fragile, damaged woman would one day buy a gun off the street, shoot me, harm my daughter. Mark? It was Mom. She knew what I was doing. Come help me, okay? I nodded and headed toward the back bedroom. Dad slept on the ground floor now. Easier than trying to get up the stairs with a wheelchair. We dressed him, which was a bit like dressing wet sand. My father lolls from side to side. His weight has a tendency towards sudden shifts. My mother and I were used to that, but it doesn't make the task less arduous. When my mother kissed me goodbye, the faint and familiar whiff of breath mint and cigarette smoke came off her. I had urged her to quit. She kept promising, but I knew that it would never happen. I noticed how loose the skin on her neck was getting, her gold chains almost embedded in their folds. She leaned down and kissed my father on the cheek, holding her lips to him a few seconds too long. "Be careful," she told us. Then again, that was what she always told us. We began our journey. I pushed Dad past the train station. We live in a commuter town. Mostly men, but yes, women, too, were lined up in long coats, briefcase in one hand, coffee cup in the other. This might sound odd, but even before 9/11, these people were heroes to me. They board that damn train 5 times a week. They take it to Hoboken and switch to the path. That train takes them into New York City. Some will head up to 33rd Street and change to hit Midtown. Others will take it to the financial center, now that it's opened up again. They make the everyday sacrifice, stifling their own wants and dreams in order to provide for those they love. I could be doing cosmetic plastic surgery and making a mint. My parents would be able to afford better care for my dad. They could move someplace nice, get that full-time nurse, find a place that could cater more to their needs. But I don't do that. I don't help them by taking the more traveled route because, frankly, working such a job would bore me. So I choose to do something more exciting, something I love to do. For that, people think I'm the heroic one, that I am the one making the sacrifice. Here's the truth. The person who works with the poor, they are usually more selfish. We are not willing to sacrifice our needs. Working a job that provides for our families is not enough for us. Supporting those we love is secondary. We need personal satisfaction, even if our own family is made to do without. Those suits I now watch numbingly board the New Jersey Transit train, they often hate where they are going and what they are doing, but they do it anyway. They do it to take care of their families, to provide a better life for their spouses, their children, and maybe, just maybe, their aging and ill parents. So really, which one of us is to be admired? Dad and I followed the same route every Thursday. We took the path around the park behind the library. The park was chock full, and you'll notice a suburban theme here, of soccer fields. How much quality real estate was tied up in this supposedly second-tier foreign sport? My father seemed comforted by the playground, by the sights and sounds of children at play. We stopped and took deep breaths. I glanced to my left. Several healthy women jogged by, clad in your finest, sheer, clingy lycra. Dad seemed very still. I smiled. Maybe Dad liking this spot had nothing to do with soccer. I no longer remember what my father used to be like. When I try to think back that far, my memories are snapshots, flashes. A man's deep laugh, a little boy clinging to his bicep, dangling off the ground. That was pretty much it. I remember that I loved him deeply, and I guess that has always been enough. After his second stroke 16 years ago, Dad's speech became extremely labored. He'd get stuck mid-sentence. He'd drop words. He'd go silent for hours and sometimes days. He'd forget that he was there. No one really knew for sure if he understood, if he had classic expressive aphasia, you understand, but you can't really communicate, or something even more sinister. But on a hot June day during my senior year of high school, my father suddenly reached out and grabbed hold of my sleeve with an eagle talon grip. I'd been heading out to a party at the time. Lenny was waiting for me by the door. My father's surprisingly strong grasp stopped me cold. I looked down. His face was pure white, the tendons of his neck taut, and more than anything, what I saw was naked fear. That look on his face haunted my sleep for years afterward. I slid into the chair next to him, his hand still clutching my arm. "Dad? I understand," he pleaded. His grip on my sleeve tightened. "Please." Every word was a struggle. "I still understand." That was all he said. But it was enough. What I took it to mean was this. Even though I can't speak or respond, I comprehend. Please don't shut me out. For a while, the doctors agreed. He had expressive aphasia. Then he had another stroke, and the doctors became less sure of what he did and did not understand. I don't know if I apply my own version of Pascal's wager here. If he understands me, then I should talk to him. If he doesn't, what's the harm? But I figure that I owe him that. So I talk to him. I tell him everything. And right now I was telling him about Dina Levinsky's visit. Do you remember her, Dad? And the hidden CD. Dad's face was locked, immobile, the left side of his mouth turned down in an angry slash hook. I often wished that he and I never had that I understand conversation. I don't know which is worse, to be beyond comprehension or to understand how trapped you really are. Or maybe I do know. I was making the second turn, the one by the new skateboard run, when I spotted my former father-in-law. Edgar Portman sat on a bench, splendid in his casual best, his legs crossed, his pants crease sharp enough to slice tomatoes. After the shootings, Edgar and I tried to keep up a relationship that had never existed when his daughter was alive. We had hired a detective agency together. Edgar, of course, knew the best, but they came up with nothing. After a while, Edgar and I both grew weary of the pretense. The only bond between us was the one that conjured up the worst moment of my life. Edgar's being here could, of course, have been a coincidence. We live in the same town. It would only be natural to bump into one another from time to time. But that wasn't the case. I knew that. Edgar was not one for casual park visits. He was here for me. Our eyes met, and I wasn't sure I liked what I saw. I wheeled the chair toward the bench. Edgar kept his eyes on me, never glancing down at my father. I might as well have been pushing a shopping cart. "Your mother told me I'd find you here," Edgar said. I stopped a few feet away from him. "What's up?" "Sit with me." I set my father's chair on my left. I lowered the brake. My father stared straight out. His head lolled toward his right shoulder, the way it does when he gets tired. I turned and faced Edgar. He uncrossed his legs. "I've been wondering how to tell you this," he began. I gave him a little space. He looked off. "Edgar?" "Hmm. Just tell me." He nodded, appreciating my directness. Edgar was that kind of man. Without preamble, he said, "I got another ransom demand." I reeled back. I don't know what I had expected to hear. Maybe that Tara had been found dead. But what he was saying, I couldn't quite comprehend it. I was about to ask a follow-up question when I saw that he now had a satchel in his lap. He opened it and pulled something into view. It was in a plastic bag, just like the last time we went through this. I squinted. He handed it to me. Something ballooned in my chest. I blinked and looked at the bag. Hairs. There were hairs inside it. "This is their proof," Edgar said. I could not speak. I just looked at the hairs. I laid the bag gently on my lap. "They understood that we would be skeptical," Edgar said.
"Who understood?"
"The kidnappers. They said they'd give us a few days. I immediately brought the hairs to a DNA laboratory." I looked up at him and then back at the hairs. "The preliminary results came in 2 hours ago," Edgar said. "Nothing they could use in court, but it's still pretty conclusive. The hairs match the ones sent to us a year and a half ago." He stopped and swallowed. "The hairs belong to Tara." I heard the words. I didn't understand them. For some reason, I shook my head no. "Maybe they just saved them from before." "No. They have aging tests, too. Those hairs came from a child around 2 years old." I guess that I knew that already. I could look and see that these were not my daughter's wispy baby hairs. She wouldn't have them anymore. Her hair would have darkened and thickened. Edgar handed me a note. Still in a fog, I took it from him. The font was the same as from the note we'd gotten 18 months before. The top line over the fold said, "Want one last chance?" I felt the thud deep in my chest. Edgar's voice seemed suddenly far away. "I probably should have told you immediately, but it seemed an obvious hoax. Carson and I didn't want to get your hopes up unnecessarily. I have friends. They were able to rush through the DNA results. We still had hairs from the last mailing." He put a hand on my shoulder. I did not move. "She's alive, Mark. I don't know how or where. But Tara is alive. My eyes stayed on the hairs. Tara. They belonged to Tara. The sheen, that golden wheat hue. I petted them through the plastic. I wanted to reach inside the bag to touch my daughter, but I thought my heart would burst. They want another $2 million. The note warns us again about calling the police. They claim to have an inside source. They sent another cell phone for you. I have the money in the car. We have another 24 hours, maybe. That was the window they gave us for the DNA testing. You'll have to be ready. I finally read the note. Then I looked over at my father in his wheelchair. He still stared straight ahead. Edgar said, I know you think I'm rich. I am, I guess. But not like you'd think. I'm leveraged, and I turned toward him. His eyes were wide. His hands shook. What I mean to say is that I don't really have that many liquid assets left. I'm not made of money. This is it. I'm surprised you're doing this at all, I said. The words I could see immediately wounded him. I wanted to take them back, but for some reason I didn't. I let my eyes drift back toward my father. Dad's face remained frozen, but I looked closer. There was a tear on his cheek. That didn't mean anything. Dad has teared up before, usually with no apparent provocation. I did not take this as any kind of sign. And then, I don't know why, I followed his gaze. I looked across the soccer field, past the goalposts, past two women with baby joggers, all the way to the street nearly 100 yards away. My stomach dropped. There, standing on the sidewalk, looking back at me with his hands in his pockets, was a man wearing a flannel shirt and black jeans and a Yankee cap. I couldn't say for sure that it was the same man. Red and black flannel is hardly an uncommon pattern, and maybe it was my imagination. I was pretty far away, but I think he was smiling at me. I felt my whole body jerk. Edgar said, Mark? I barely heard him. I rose and kept my eyes up. At first, the man in the flannel stayed perfectly still. I ran toward him. Mark! But I knew that it was no mistake. You don't forget. You close your eyes and you still see him. He never leaves you. You wish for moments like this. I knew that. And I knew what wishes could bring. But I ran straight toward him, because there was no mistake. I knew who it was. When I was still a good distance away, the man lifted his hand and waved to me. I kept moving, but I could already see that it was futile. I was only halfway across the park when a white van drove up. The man in flannel snapped a salute in my direction before disappearing into the back. The van was out of sight before I reached the street. Chapter 13. Time started playing games with me, going in and out, speeding up and slowing down, in focus and suddenly blurred. But that did not last long. I let the surgeon side of me take over. He, Mark the doctor, knew how to compartmentalize. I've always found this easier to do at work than in my personal life. The skill, to partition, to separate, to detach, has never translated. At work, I am able to take my emotional excess and channel it, allow it to converge into a constructive focus.